field. So we are absolutely saying no to it. And my district, the LA Unified School District, I believe has already responded and said this is not something that we are going to comply with. And so across the board, we are saying this is not acceptable to us, and we are not complying with it because we see it for what it is.
Nisha, I wanted to go to an issue here in New York. Last week, a judge temporarily halted efforts by Mayor Eric Adams to reopen an ICE office inside the Rikers Island jail complex. Adams first signaled the move after he met with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, in February. At the time, the New York Civil Liberties Union slammed Adams' administration for selling out New Yorkers for Trump's dangerous deportation regime. The group said in a statement, quote, ICE's presence on Rikers serves no legitimate purpose, opens the door to unlawful collusion between local law enforcement and federal immigration officials in violation of our city's well-established sanctuary protections. New Yorkers see this for what it is, Mayor Adams skirting the city council, cozying up to Trump and putting New Yorkers, immigrant New Yorkers, in harm's way, the group said. And we all know about the Trump administration dropping the charges against Mayor Eric Adams, which many people called a quid pro quo for him then doing their bidding around immigration. If you can respond to what Eric Adams is pushing for, what the judge has stopped.
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, luckily we live in a city that has a really strong city council that has passed really strong immigrant protections in New York City. The city council has sued to stop the Adams administration executive order from allowing ICE on Rikers, and there is a temporary restraining order. And I think this shows us that, like, we really need our state leadership to take strong action to protect immigrant communities and workers and families in New York. You know, Make the Road New York, along with labor unions and other immigrant groups, are pushing for New York for All, which is a law that would prevent cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. No one should have their rights be different based on where they live, right? The goal of New York for All is to standardize these strong immigrant protections across the state, not just in New York City. We have county executives in Nassau, Long Island, you know, collaborating with the federal government willingly to have detectives cooperating with ICE. And this would prevent that, right? This is the time where we actually really need our state leaders to step up and incorporate protections and standardize protections across the board, not just in New York City. Your rights should not be different based on where you live.
And Jorge Mujica, I'm wondering if you could talk about where people are gathering in Chicago on May Day and what the plans are for the protest that day.
Yeah, we are gathering at 11 a.m. at Union Park, the corner of Lake and Ashland Avenues. And we're going to be marching across downtown all the way pretty much to Lake Michigan. We're going to cross the whole downtown. We will be arriving at Grand Park around maybe 2 to 2:30 p.m. And we will have a program continuous for, until 4 p.m. or so. We have over 180 labor unions and community organizations, and everybody wants to speak because, again, since everybody's under attack, everybody has a say on this. So everybody wants to speak. It's going to be a long program, the whole day going on, and we hope everybody comes over. We are expecting about 500,000 people there.
And I wanted to ask Jorge Mujica about ICE entering the schools in Chicago and the response overall of the community.
Oh, they have tried. The Secret Service back in January tried to detain or interrogate at least an 11-year-old kid at a school. And that prompted a strong response from the city of Chicago. We have now in place a full policy on who's responsible for, impeding entry to ICE agencies or FBI or Secret Service if they don't follow due procedure, due process. Nobody can enter a school at any time. They are designated persons to talk to the kids about it. The city put a whole plan together for the safety of the kids.
And what about, Nisha, here in New York, executive order that was signed yesterday, the targeting of sanctuary cities? Yeah. What does that mean for New York City?
It means that New York City really needs to stand steadfast in its protections of years of advocacy passing laws that protect immigrants coming into New York. They make up the fabric of everyday life. Immigrant New Yorkers, you know, their labor powers our cities and they make our cities vibrant. Studies have shown sanctuary city laws actually make our communities safer. It fosters actually more trust between immigrants and law enforcement to come forward and report crime. So we're really like urging cities and states to remain steadfast in their protections and not, you know, give in to these threats from the Trump administration.
And finally, Georgia Flowers, what are the plans for the rallies and the marches on May Day in Los Angeles for those people from that area who may want to participate?
So we are meeting at 9 a.m. in the intersection of Figueroa Street and Olympic Boulevard, gathering together with hopefully 100,000 of our friends and neighbors, and we are marching through downtown to City Hall. So we're looking for folks to come out and join us, and there's every indication that it's going to be massive.
And before you go, Georgia Flowers Lee in Los Angeles, as an educator and a person who's particularly concerned with children on the autism spectrum, how have Trump's budget cuts impacted kids, particularly in your schools?
So we are watching what the effect of these proposed cuts could be. So our students are entitled, or students with special needs, particularly on the autism spectrum, are entitled to supports that allow them to thrive, to show up as their best selves in our classrooms. And so we are pushing to make sure that those supports remain. However, whatever the federal government cuts has to be made up for at the local level. And so our district, our state, will have to absorb those costs, which means that, you know, there will be less to fund all our students if the federal government is not providing what it should to help support our neediest students. So we are pushing our district to make sure that they continue to get whatever they can. And we are really impressing on our state legislature to continue to provide for our students, to make sure that our students have access and that they have the resources that they need.
Georgia Flowers Lee, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Vice President for United Teachers Los Angeles, Jorge Mujica of Arise Chicago, and Nisha Tabassum of Make the Road New York, all involved with organizing Métis protests beginning on Thursday. On this 100th day, this conversation taking place of President Trump back in office. Coming up, we speak with Palestinian-American writer Sada Aziza, author of the new book, The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders. Stay with us.
And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breeze. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute. How did Mandela get the will to surpass the everyday when injustice had him caged and trapped in every way? How did Gandhi ever withstand the hunger strikes and all? Didn't do it to gain power or money, if I recall. It's the gift I guess I pass it on. Mother thinks it'll lift the stress of Babylon. Mother knows. My mother, she suffered blows. I don't know how we survived such violent episodes. I was so worried. It hurt to see you bleed. But as soon as you came out the hospital, you gave me sweets. Yeah. They tried to take you from me, but you still only gave them some prayers and sympathy. Dear mama, you helped me write this by showing me to give is priceless. And any man who knows a thing knows he knows not a damn thing at all. And every time I felt the hurt and I felt the giving getting me up off the wall, I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it breathe. I'm just gonna take a minute and let it ride. I'm just gonna take a minute. All I can say is the worst is over now. We can serve the hard times.
Take a Minute by the Somali-Canadian musician Kanan, performing in our Democracy Now! Studios back in 2009. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The International Court of Justice is holding a week-long hearing on Israel's obligations to provide aid to Gaza. On Monday, Palestinian envoy Amr Hijazi accused Israel of using humanitarian aid as weapons of war as Israel continues its devastating blockade.
That's really the heart of why Palestine and over 40 other states are addressing the court today. It is not about the number of aid trucks Israel is or is not allowing into the occupied Palestinian territory, especially Gaza. It is not about Israel destroying the it is about Israel destroying the fundamentals of life in Palestine while it blocks UN and other humanitarians from providing life-saving aid to the population. It is about Israel unraveling fundamental principles of international law, including their obligations under the UN Charter. It is about Israel turning Palestine, and particularly Gaza, into a mass grave for Palestinians and those coming to their aid.
We end today's show with a new memoir by the award-winning Palestinian-American journalist and author, Sara Aziza. She was born in the United States as a daughter and granddaughter of Palestinian refugees from Gaza. Her new book is called The Hollow Half, a memoir of bodies and borders. In it, she examines her recovery from anorexia that she nearly died from in 2019 as part of the generational trauma experienced as part of her Palestinian family's history of exile. We welcome you to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us. The Paris Review just published an excerpt of your new book, The Hollow Half. Congratulations on its publication. You have this quote, "You were dead, Sara. You were dead." In October 2019, you entered the hospital. You were suffering from anorexia. Many believed it could be fatal for you. And that is not only so real in your body, but it has also become a metaphor for what you describe your family, the post-traumatic stress disorder from what's happening in Gaza. Can you lay out what happened to you and how you broaden that to your family and people's experience?
Thank you so much, Amy. It's an honor for me to be here. Thank you for your work. So the story does start with my body sort of being shattered and nearly erased by this mental health issue that I was dealing with that I thought, you know, according to the medical Western model, I accepted the diagnosis that this was an individual disease, something I needed to wrestle with and recover. But as I sort of traced in the book, even beginning in the hospital, I began to recover memories of my Palestinian grandmother that led to a curiosity, a deeper curiosity about my family's history in Gaza and Palestine, the greater Nakba. And as a daughter of the diaspora, I hadn't tied my own story so viscerally to the story of my people. Of course, I knew it, but sort of the understanding that many people in the diaspora have is we've crossed this threshold, this border, right? Whether it's a temporal border or a geographical border of we're the safe ones. We made it out, and you know, we pray for Gaza, we maybe organize for Gaza, but somehow we're a little bit more protected here in the United States. But what this book really examines is both the incredible inspiration that I directly draw from my grandmother, who is an illiterate, disabled, small woman who survived the Nakba, the 1967 war, was displaced from Gaza. You know, sort of the kind of woman that's not held up to us in the United States or even, you know, maybe in broader culture as a hero and as a model. I was following the model of the American dream, the meritocracy. I was believed that if I could advance myself, you know, I could make my Baba proud, I could make my grandmother proud, but I didn't need to tie my own story so directly to her. But what I realized was that her suffering and her loss, but also her resilience, carried some of the keys that I needed to recover from my individual malady and sort of reorient my life with Gaza and Palestine at its center, rather than falling for, I guess, the line of the American dream, which ends up being hollow and betraying most all of us, as your guests today, you know, sort of laid out in some very real present ways.
And Sarah, could you talk about the title, The Hollow Half? Mm-hmm.
Of course, yeah. I mean, as I was just, you know, sort of alluding to, the hollowness is, there's many dimensions to it, I think. One of them is the hollowness of the hunger, right, and the anorexia that the book begins with. But it's also the hollowness of the American dream, and it's also the hollowness of this idea of halfness, this idea of being half American, half Palestinian. By the end of the book, I'm sort of rejecting that. I'm sort of coming to understand that Palestinianness is a whole identity, and it speaks to every part of my life, whether I'm in the diaspora or outside of it. So yeah, it kind of unfolds the further the book goes along.
And as someone who works with translation from Arabic into English, you write about the Arabic word zikr for memory. Can you talk about how memory in Arabic is a living thing?
I love that question. Yeah, the fourth chapter is named after this Arabic word zikr, which means both to remember and to invoke. So the book begins with memory. It begins with recovering from the archive and the family archive all that was sort of lost or left behind as my family moved from their ancestral home, which was destroyed and ethnically cleansed in 1948, into Gaza, and then after the 67 war, out of Gaza, into Syria, Jordan, and eventually Saudi Arabia. So this is a form of memory, right? Recovering from history, what was erased or written over or discarded by the powers that be. But dhikr also means to invoke. So it was sort of an answering of a call, a calling back to Palestine, realizing that Palestine really invokes the value system that I want to adopt as a Palestinian, but also anyone who seeks to defy empire and search for a different future for all of us. I think we're seeing every day how pressing and urgent the need for a different future is. So it's an invocation as well as a remembering.
Sona, can you talk about how you've kept in touch with your family in Gaza now, sharing their messages with the world? Talk about people like your cousin, Nabil, and how you've been translating his writing and his poetry.
Yeah, thank you for bringing my family into this conversation. Yeah, the book was, I started writing it in 2020, but I was still finishing it in 2023 when the genocide escalated. You know, we could say the genocide's been going on for decades. But so, yeah, we have a lot of family in Gaza. My family's lost in the greater, like, you know, extended family, over 200 people. But there's a...
Where do they live?
They were in Nusrat refugee camp, Deir al-Balah, some of them in Khan Yunus, also in Jabalia. So all over. Of course, it's been unspeakably heartbreaking and horrific, and a deep challenge to find words. Actually, the dedication of this book is, for Gaza, words fail. So I wrote this book, but I also recognize the limits of language. But as you you know, beautifully brought to our attention. I did translate some of my cousin Nabil's poetry. He's been sending these missives, you know, to me and my parents quite frequently from Gaza. And, you know, he's a pharmacist, actually, but lost his job, of course, in all the destruction. But it turns out he's a poet as well. The ways that he speaks of his despair some days, his hope other days, his pain, his hunger most recently in this, you know, increasingly intense famine that he's facing. It was a gift to be able to publish some of his words. I hope to do more. As a Palestinian in the diaspora, I mean, I'm honored to have a book out. My cousin Nabil even messaged me saying they were proud, they feel remembered. But I think it's always so important to point back to the voices in Gaza. So I hope to do more of that, you know, as my career goes on. I want to elevate and translate and bring Palestinian voices from inside the land to the broader community, yeah.
Could you talk as well about your cousin Hanin, who was 26 years old and set to graduate from college a few months after October 7th, 2023?
Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah. Hanin is Nabil's sister. She's also just this incredibly precious soul. She's continuing, you know, to send us messages as well. But yeah, she was getting ready to graduate from college, you know, having survived so many wars and still being able to continue her education, then higher education. When the war started and they were displaced for the first time, she brought her graduation gown and cap with her, you know, as they fled from one place to another. And I think that just speaks to this duality that Palestinians, particularly in Gaza and you know, the greater historic Palestine, have to hold constantly. It's the same, you know, hope that drove my father to, you know, continue to overcome one obstacle after another, as I trace in the book. So Hanin is just such an inspiration to me. She has continued to educate her younger brothers, you know, sort of like homeschool them throughout these displacements. And, you know, I spoke to her on the phone somewhat recently, not as recently as I would have liked, as it's difficult. But, you know, she still has high spirits most days. I know it's I don't want to sugarcoat it. Resilience is a complicated thing and it has its limits. But I would love to be half the woman that she is someday. Mm.
Sara, you write in your book about your father and grandmother's return to Gaza, to the smell of the sea, to the moment of joy. Can you talk more about their experiences and how you experience Gaza here? You were actually born here.
Yeah. Thank you. That's one of my favorite parts of the book, getting to reconstruct this moment. My father was born in Deir al-Balah, Gaza, and then in 67, when he was 7 years old, they were displaced to Saudi Arabia. But then as a teenager, he and his mother went back to visit Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah. And, you know, just this moment he describes of, you know, he was living in Saudi Arabia, so around other Arabs, speaking Arabic. But when he crossed over and began hearing the Ghazan dialect and smelling the sea, you know, his body remembered the sea maybe in ways he didn't even know he was carrying. So, you know, he just describes this feeling of aliveness, this familial sense of, I'm with my people again. He said, I wanted to run to each one and take their hand and tell them, I'm one of you, we're family. And from there, you know, he discovers as a young man Palestine all over again, because this is a diaspora experience of trying to get as close to our land and our history as we can, with one set of obstacles after another. And each year and each decade, it gets harder. But yeah, so I also got to revisit Palestine several times using the privilege of my American passport. I spent a few months in Nablus, and then my brother, father, and I were able to find the traces of our family village, which was destroyed in 1948. It's in rubble. The cemetery was razed by either a bulldozer or a tank, but there's still traces. And I think Palestinians everywhere are finding whatever way they can to continue to connect to that history and to bring that history into the present and to use that history to inform our hope for the future.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you could talk some about the emotional changes that you've gone through as you see now the Israeli war, the massacres in Gaza continuing, and the rest of the world refusing to do anything substantive about Israel, and also being here in the United States, where anyone who protests this genocide is immediately criminalized and persecuted, whether it's by universities or the government or even sometimes the media.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, again, this is one of the reasons I appreciate this programming, is it's a place where I've seen courageous reporting when and elevating of Palestinian voices when I'm not seeing a fraction of what we need to see. So thank you again. It's been horrific. It's been, it feels like a privilege to even talk about how horrible it's been for me, because I know nothing compares to what the Palestinians in Palestine and specifically Gaza are going through. But it's propelled me to dedicate myself ever more to these stories, to preserving and defending all the beauty and the abundance that is Palestine. You know, we are more than a genocide. We are more than Nakba. So it's, again, that duality of, in this book, there are many moments of joy and lushness and abundance, but also these moments of horror and heartbreak. And, you know, that's really just, you know, a small example of the larger scale of the Palestinian experience that you speak to. I think the last almost 2 years now has been this strange sense of deja vu, but on a scale, you know, none of us ever wanted to imagine. There's this sense of the externalization of history, like this thing that I knew in my body and carried in my body and my DNA, you know, of there is a force that's trying to erase us from the earth. There's a force that wants to silence our stories, that wants to silence anyone who would speak out, you know, in solidarity with us. It's been a very lonely and isolated sort of experience being a Palestinian in the U.S. Again, not to privilege my suffering, but I think the world is starting to see what Palestinians and those who have been paying attention have always known, which is Zionism is a relentless and totalizing project. It won't stop until we're erased and we're gone. And there is no amount of nuance. There's not a modicum of nuance to Zionism. And as the U.S., which is also a Zionist country, has doubled down on its Zionist policies and intentions, both under Biden and now under Trump, I think that the lines are just clearer than ever. I hope that people understand, if they didn't before, that Zionism, as well as just like the U.S. imperial project, is a project of anti-life. You know, there's no life for Palestinians, and there's no life for many of us as long as these projects are allowed to go on. So I commend the courage of the students and the journalists and the academics and the everyday people on the street who've been standing with us. And I just hope that we can continue to push forward, because any hope that Palestinians have, it begins first and foremost with the people on the ground resisting the absolute brute force of empire, which is coming to bear with everything it has on Gaza, but also here in the U.S., that we need to stay steadfast.
And what has it meant to you that so many of those, for example, have been arrested, mm-hmm. have been Jewish, that Jewish solidarity with Palestinians mm-hmm. fighting what is taking place?
I mean, I think it just completely cuts out at the knees this argument that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. I think that, again, that's such a disingenuous argument. It always has been. You know, actually, the PLO charter in the 1960s that they issued, you know, sort of, this is the resistance group that was resisting Zionism. They said that anyone who is Jewish, who lived on the land, you know, originally, was considered Palestinian. You know, this is like, we've always been a pluralistic society, a multi-faith society. Again, this idea that's a religious war or an anti-Semitic project, absolutely false. Of course, there's been, you know, there's an ancient Jewish community on historic Palestine. This is, you know, not about the identity of those that are massacring us, but it is about the massacre itself. Massacres, genocide, ethnic cleansing, imperialism, these are wrong no matter who is perpetrating them. And we are ready to work, as you mentioned, hand in hand with anyone of any identity who wants to stand in solidarity. So we're grateful for those partners.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Sara Aziza, the Palestinian-American journalist and author. Her new book is just out. It's called The Hollow Half, A Memoir of Bodies and Borders. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for an individual giving manager to support our fundraising team. You can learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Zakwath Nazal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Ich bin Arndt Peltner von Radio Goethe. Ihr hört Mike mit Noise of Corporate right here on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca. Hello, this is Arndt Peltner, host of Radio Goethe. You're listening to Mike and his Noise of Corporate, celebrating the indie noises of the 90s on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.